Of a extended sermon series from Jesus' sermon in the Sermon on the Mount. We are in the middle of chapter 5, which is the first of three chapters. I feel like we're making good progress, but it's going to take a while to get through. Let me remind you of what Jesus says. Jesus says, "I do not think that I have come to abolish the law. I have not come to abolish it, but to fulfill it." And so after he's talked about the Beatitudes and the metaphors of salt and light, he says, okay, now let's focus on what I want to talk about at length here. And what Jesus wants to do is he wants to raise the bar on the quality of life of his disciples, not so that they can be saved by the quality of their life, but so that they can be salt and be light by being different. He says, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, not saying that you have to do all of these works in order to be saved, but there has to be a definable, recognizable, qualitative difference in your life, A, if you become my disciples, and B, if you want to make any difference in the world around you. Then he begins by citing, okay, so he begins his examples, and the first one he says, you've heard it said to people long ago, do not murder. I tell you, anyone who is even angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Saying that, you've narrowly defined hurting or killing somebody as murder. And I'm telling you, if you act out in anger to somebody, you kill something inside of them that is precious and fragile. Don't do it. Then his second example has to do with comparing lust to adultery. And his third example is basically, you guys have gone through this system of rationalizing divorce. And I'm telling you, that was never God's intention from the beginning. Fix your problems, don't run away from them. All right, I ran across an interesting book several years ago in the Borders bookstore in the closeout section. This is normally not a good place to find a great book because nobody really wants them. But this had a clever title, The Pinocchio Nation, Embracing Truth in a Culture of Lies. I didn't buy the book, but I thumbed through it. It even has a test to determine your basic integrity or honesty quotient. I just decided I'm not going to read it, so I didn't get it. But it was this fascinating concept that we live in a culture that has become increasingly anesthetized to the truth and increasingly willing to fudge and to lie. In fact, the thing that caught my attention was this quote on the front. I love Mark Twain, so he says this. All men are liars. All men are partial hiders of the facts and half-tellers of the truth. We are all moral sneaks. When we encounter one who is clearly honest, he needs no other talent or genius to be remarkable, just his uncommon honesty. Do you think that's true? First of all, do you think all people are liars? Second of all, do you think that they're as rare as a two-headed cow? According to a recent survey in the Kansas City Star, the average American lies 20 times a day. Do you think that's true? They didn't define whether it's a bold-faced lie or a half-truth or a little white lie or a lie we tell ourselves versus a lie we tell other people. They didn't distinguish. They just said the research said 20 times a day. But you know, if I just counted the things I tell myself that aren't entirely correct, that enable me to get through a day, that's probably at least 20 right there. How about you? Whether this is accurate or not, the truth of the matter is that honesty has declined in our culture. It's probably as easily seen anywhere else as in politics, where we've gotten to the point where we don't expect politicians to tell us the truth. Well, how did we get to the point where we don't expect them to tell us the truth? Shouldn't we expect them to tell us the truth? Shouldn't we be surprised if they don't tell us the truth? But the decline and the decay and the lack of confidence that people are inherently honest is both based upon our experience and I think the secret knowledge within our hearts that we all lie. Now, social research has identified several areas in which dishonesty is most easiest to identify and most easily rationalized in our culture. Let me give you just three of them this morning. First is exaggeration. So if you're a preacher, you exaggerate. You're paid to exaggerate. This is what my peers believe, is that you got a good story that's a good sermon illustration, make it a little better. If you're going to use a statistic, well, you know, if the statistic isn't good enough, make it better. Nobody admits that they're doing this, but this is common practice in preaching. There's all kinds of permutations of this. One of them is I go overseas to South Central Asia and I say, hey, so this guy's my very good friend. And they say, so you guys live together? No. Well, so you grew up together? No. You're related to each other? No. Your parents grew up together? No. Well, how long have you known this person? Oh, 3 years. And then they have to recalibrate their definition of what a very close friend is. One of the ways in which I think we exaggerate the worst and the most damaging is that we think we're better than other people. My strengths are better than your strengths. My weaknesses are less troubling than your weaknesses. In fact, I'm probably a better person than you because I tolerate all kinds of things in myself that I won't tolerate in you. I will allow myself to be uncharitable and unkind, to gossip and to be negative about people all the time, but if you do it once towards me, I'm sorry, you failed. This is how we all think. We have completely different standards, and we exaggerate that we're a whole lot better than maybe we are, and that our shortcomings aren't quite as bad as they are, but we elevate it in comparison to other people. And what about concepts like great and awesome and wonderful and fantastic? I was in Sri Lanka and somebody said, you know, so how was the meal? And I said, wonderful. The person looks at me and says, doesn't that mean full of wonder? I said, yeah. I said, so that meal made you full of wonder? Actually, it did. I didn't know what it was, and I really wasn't all that excited about it. So you can spend a summer in the mountains and say, this was an awesome experience, and it inspired awe within you. But then how does that apply if you go to an eighth grade girls basketball game and it was awesome? Or the meal you had last night was awesome? We have devalued things by overuse and exaggeration. Second is little white lies, which we all not only tell, we all rationalize. It's not you, it's me. If she calls, tell her I'm not here. Of course, now we all have caller ID on our cell phones, so we can say, nope, I'm not going to answer that one. There was this period of time between 2000 and 2010. It happened twice, and it was like a three-year period and a two-year period, where if I was on the phone for too long because of head injuries, if I was on the phone for too long, I started to get dizzy. I don't know what it was. And then if I continued to do it, I would get nauseous. So I occasionally would say to people, I'm sorry, I've got to go, I'm getting nauseous, which didn't work really well. So I had to figure out another way of saying that. But I have a family member who wears me out talking to them anyway. And I can remember once saying, I can't stay on the phone any longer with this person. I'm sorry, I'm getting dizzy. I've got to hang up. And I wasn't getting dizzy yet. So I told a little white lie. Well, I mean, we do this all the time. And our rationalization is, well, I'm going to keep from hurting somebody's feelings. Now, there's a complete world of difference between saying let's not be sexist, if your husband says to you, how do I look in this outfit? And you say, oh, you look wonderful, and you're going, God, you need somebody to choose your outfits for you. I mean, there's a difference between that and normally what passes for little white lies that we rationalize in our lives. You remember the Jim Carrey movie Liar, Liar? Premise is that he is a compulsive liar. He tells little white lies. He can't get through life without making things up or lying about things. And his son, who's sick and tired of being misled by his father, makes this wish that his father would only be able to tell the truth. And so it comes true. And here's Jim Carrey explaining the rationale to him. We have an enormous tolerance for lies unless it affects us. And we're especially tolerant of lies if we're the one that is telling them. And by the way, I think that the worst lies that we tell are rationalizations that enable us to justify all the other lies that we tell. Now, if you only categorize lies as some bold-faced thing you make up and tell somebody else, then you can let yourself off the hook. But if you categorize lies as false advertising, as polishing the apple, as exaggerating the benefits, as minimizing the negative impact, then all of us regularly lie to ourselves and lie to others. Third, false advertising. The norm is to not have any idea what the product is being advertised on TV, am I right? In our house, we mute the commercials, and I guarantee you half the time you would have no idea what they're advertising if you're just looking at the pictures, because it's all about image. It's about telling you this lie that if you'll eat this product or wear this outfit or shampoo with this product or go to this place, then you will look beautiful and wonderful and slim and attractive and be happy and successful and everything will grow great for you. You remember those of you that are old enough back when they used to advertise on TV, they'd have a guy in a white lab coat? And there'd be like two linoleum tiles there, one of them with their wax on and the other with our wax on, and look how much better our floor wax is than their wax, because we've clinically tested this product. Boy, we don't do that anymore in advertising. We just lie with the idea of image. You remember the movie Crazy People? I think I've shared this as an illustration with you before. It's Dudley Moore is a Manhattan advertising executive who's sick and tired of all of the falsehood and lies in advertising. And so he makes up these blatantly honest advertisements, which when he gets put in a mental institution, get mistakenly run on television, and everybody's surprised the products are become sell, and everybody's wild about this advertising technique. So Manhattan has to go to him to teach them how to be blatantly honest in advertising. Here's two of my favorites. Winston cigarettes. As long as you're risking cancer, shouldn't your cigarette deliver great flavor? Shouldn't something that might kill you taste really, really good? Winston's, pulmonary cancer, perhaps. Flavor, for sure. Or John Hancock Insurance. We know you love him, but if he happens to die, we'll give you two Mercedes and a summer home. That would be nice too, wouldn't it? The real truth is surprising to hear in a context where everything promises health and wealth and beauty and success and fitness and popularity if you just wash your hair with the right shampoo. We don't believe either as a culture or as individuals anymore in showing the entire truth. I don't know if you can remember back when bacon didn't even have that little tiny panel on the back, but the way they pack bacon is you just see the edge, and you can't tell what's in there. So it used to be you had to buy it totally sight unseen, so there was a law passed that says if you package bacon, you have to show a window. Well, the window only shows one-third of one slice of bacon. Doesn't show you the other two-thirds of that one slice or what the rest of it looks all the way up inside the package. It drives me crazy. And to me, I know this sounds silly, but for me, this is a metaphor for our culture. We hide the truth and we present that which looks most favorable, but the painful reality to me is I do the same thing. I hide the truth and I present what makes me look most favorable. According to a survey conducted by George Barna, 70% of Americans believe there is no such thing as absolute truth. And since only 15% strongly disagreed in the survey, that means approximately 85% of Americans are at least open to the idea that truth is a moving target. Now, you've heard this before, that in our culture, that it's popular to say, well, that's true for you, but it's not true for me. Well, I don't believe there is such thing as absolute truth. Well, it's not true in this situation. And so we make it used to be that culture oriented around the fact that there's certain black and white things, and now the black and white things are virtually gone anymore. Stanford University conducted a survey of 25 years worth of graduates. Over a 25 consecutive year period, promised them total anonymity. They didn't know who they were, and said, did you cheat while you were at Stanford? And in fact asked, did you seriously cheat while you were at Stanford? 45% of 25 years of graduating classes said that they seriously cheated while at Stanford. Then they did a follow-up survey and said, what school did you go to? And they compared those that went to public universities versus those that went to Harvard, MIT, Caltech, and Stanford, the two liberal arts and technical prestigious institutions on both coasts, and said, how much did you cheat? 46%. So K-State and KU were 1% worse at serious cheating than Stanford. Well, does it surprise you that they cheat in Stanford? Should it surprise you that they cheat at KU or K-State? It is an epidemic problem, and how do you get to the point where you say, I'm going to cheat? Well, because I was busy partying the night before. Well, because I needed an A on that test, and I couldn't afford to get a B, so I needed to cheat. And round in our head go these reasons for, well, it was okay for me to do this because I needed it. This is basically the way our mind works as part of our sinful nature. I need this to happen because I need this, and therefore I need to do whatever I need to do or say whatever I need to say. Now, that thought doesn't go through our head, but we practice that anyway. Jesus directly addresses this problem in the Sermon on the Mount. In our passage for this morning, Jesus says this, and I'm going to read this to you from a paraphrase. Never say anything you don't mean. You only make matters worse when you offer a smokescreen of pious promises, saying things like, I'll pray for you, and not doing it. By the way, how many of you do that? I'll pray for you and then don't pray. God be with you and not meaning it. You don't make your words true by embellishing them or speaking them more passionately. Trying to make your speech sound more trustworthy actually makes it less truthful. Just say yes or no. For when you manipulate words and their meaning to accomplish your purposes, you end up making a mockery of truth. This is one of the worst translations in the entire Bible, but it's basically saying the same thing. I mean, this paraphrase is like, you wonder, how in the world did they get to this paraphrase? But it makes the basic point. Say what you mean and mean what you say. If you say yes, make it yes. If you say no, make it no. Man, we're not going to finish today. Here's one of the things that I think frustrated Jesus, is that the organizers of the law, the interpreters of the law, had come to the point where they decided, you know, the law is really inconvenient because it requires us to do things that we don't want to do. Let's create some loopholes. And so they came up with what I think of as a shrink-to-fit version of the law. Let's just sort of define this in such a way that it allows me to slip around the end on this side or slip around the end on this side. And Jesus is basically saying to them, you have come up with ways of getting around the law and you totally miss the point. The point is that honesty is at the core of the character of God. If we can't have trust in who God is, we can't have faith. If we don't believe that God is faithful to his promises, then we're in big trouble. I had a wedding several years ago, well, probably 12 years ago, in which they said to me, we want to take this phrase out of the our wedding service that says, we promise before God and these witnesses, and we don't like this phrase, so long as we both shall live, we want to substitute, so long as our love shall last. I didn't end up marrying them. Jody mentioned the troubling law in New York State that has now said you can abort a child all the way up until the day before it's born. Now, how are we able to do this? Because we have defined a fetus not as a person. A person is defined as a human being who's outside of the womb. Doesn't matter how long you're in the womb, if you're in there 9 full months and 1 day short of being born, you're not a human being. You're not a person, you're only still just a fetus. And so our culture has come up with a shrink-to-fit version of the Sixth Commandment that would be mind-blowing to anybody living 50 years ago or before. It is such an astounding rationalization. I wonder, so if somebody who holds this view or in the church is sympathetic to this view, and there's all kinds of reasons for it, but they normally come down to this. It's embarrassing. It derails my plans for my future. I don't want to take responsibility for previous choices that I've made. And you get down to the exception, which is my life is in danger or I was raped by a guy and I don't want to carry his child. You know that we live in a culture of the exception. So what we do is we say, well, it would be okay to lie to protect a Jew during Nazi persecution. Because it would be okay to lie to protect a Jew who would be hauled off and killed, then all kinds of things follow from that. Because it's okay that to have an abortion if somebody was raped, then now it's okay as long as you've got a reason why you think it's okay. So if you had this conversation with God and you said, God, I'm sorry I disagree with you on this. Oh, really? Yes, we've decided in our culture that a woman has a right to choose as to whether it's a life or not a life in her body. Oh, really? I sometimes wonder for myself, if I was to stop and carry on my conversations with God, how far would I get with them? In fact, I wonder for you as well, if you were to stop and carry on some of your rationalizations as if you and I were in a conversation with God, how far would we get before we'd go, I don't think that would fly with God. So why does that fly with me? How do we get to a point, by the way, in a culture where you have to swear in court that you're telling the truth and be threatened with punishment in order to really believe whether somebody's telling the truth or not? I mean, you used to have to place your hand on the Bible. You don't have to do that anymore because there's so many holy books out there, of course. But why is it that you have to swear that you're telling the truth so that you can be believed that you're telling the truth? What does that say about our culture? I'm sorry, I'm struggling with my head injury symptoms today and my brain is not working really well, so bear with me. Second way in which religious leaders of Jesus' day utilized a shrink-to-fit view of the law is they would talk about oaths as only being binding if you make them in God's name. So if you make them in any other name other than God's name, you can get out of it. But if you say in God's name, then you have to keep your promise. John MacArthur, who commentating on this passage, says this, "The system of oaths between people had become something of a game for the religious leaders of Jesus' day. People would swear by heaven, by the earth, by the temple, by the hairs on their heads, or by any other thing they thought would impress those they wanted to take advantage of. And so oath-making became a creative form of lie-making. It was considered acceptable as long as you was not in the name of the Lord. So the command, you shall not swear falsely by my name, was conveniently interpreted to mean swearing falsely by any other name was okay. Thus, God's standard of absolute truthfulness was lowered to accommodate the sinful, selfish desires of men." Jesus has this to say concerning this subject in Matthew chapter 23. What arrogant stupidity. You say if a person makes a promise with his fingers crossed, that's nothing. But if he swears with his hand on the Bible, that's serious? Is the leather on the Bible more binding than the skin on your hands? If you shake hands on a promise, that's nothing. But if you raise your hand to God, is your witness that serious? What ridiculous hair splitting. What difference does it make whether you shake hands or raise hands? A promise is a promise. This is basically what Jesus is saying. Make your yes, yes, and your no, no. A promise is a promise. Interestingly, James, the apostle who wrote the epistle of James, was Jesus' brother. He grew up in the same house for probably at least 20, 25 years. And he says something strangely like Jesus. He says, "Above all, my brothers and sisters, do not swear, not by heaven or by earth or anything else. Let your yes be yes and your no, no, or you will be condemned." Sometimes I feel like the church is the phoniest place on earth because we polish the apple, because we emphasize the positive and downplay the negative. We say one thing and do another. I sometimes wonder if we shouldn't post a sign on the church that says, everyone is forgiven here, but it only works if you admit that you're flawed and broken and sinful. No need to come in here if you can't admit that first. I am flawed and broken and sinful. I wrestle with rationalizing all kinds of things. I allow my brain to go places that it shouldn't go. I allow myself to justify thoughts and some of the things I do because I've concluded that it's okay and it's not okay. I don't have anything that's so horrible that it would be just a death for me to admit, but that's not the point. The point is in every day in little ways I tell myself lies that enable me to live the life I live and think the way I think, and I'm sick and tired of it. I want to live a life of consistent integrity. I don't want to have to tell everybody what's going on in my head and in my life, but I don't have to be embarrassed about what's going on in my head and in my life. So here's my homework for you this week. because this is a two-part sermon, and we're going to stop in the middle of it. Every morning, pray this prayer. God, I want to stop and think about what I'm doing today. I want to stop and think about what I'm thinking today. And in the process of your thinking and in the process of your doing, keep asking yourself the question, am I being honest? Am I being a person of integrity? Am I pretending? Am I exaggerating? Am I advertising falsely? Am I polishing the apple? Am I emphasizing the positive and de-emphasizing the negative? Ask yourself how your brain is working and how your mouth is operating and how you're living your life, and see if you can catch yourself and recognizing just how dependent you are upon rationalizing, as am I, things that aren't true and little lies in our lives. You've heard this story before. I read the story about a woman of wealth and social prominence who wanted to have a biography written of her genealogy and her family history. This may be true. I don't know if it's true. Most people, I think, have heard this as a joke, but I heard recently that this was true. So she got a well-known author to look into her family background to do research, and when he came back for the first draft, he said to her, you know, I found some really interesting things about your family, but did you know that one of your great-grandfathers was a murderer who was in Sing Sing prison, that's in New York, and who was electrocuted in the electric chair for his offense? And she said, oh, you can't put that in the biography. He says, well, ma'am, if you want me to write it, I have to say the truth. She begs him, well, this would be so embarrassing for me. She pleads with him, and finally he agrees to figure out some way to say it that doesn't sound quite so bad. And this is what he wrote. One of her grandfathers occupied a chair of applied electricity in one of the America's best-known institutions, a position of prominence he maintained until the day he died. Okay, so this is a silly example, but I am so aware every day, increasingly now that I've been thinking about this, of the way I go through all kinds of contortions to think what I think and do what I do. I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want you to do that anymore. But you have to be aware of it, and you have to target it as something that is a goal for you. Will you please join me in prayer? Father, it's a whole lot easier to find fault in others than in ourselves. It's a whole lot easier to point fingers out than in. It's a whole lot easier to notice what's wrong in other people and to be offended and bothered by what's wrong in other people and to not spend a whole lot of energy trying to fix ourselves. Lord, may we not be so lazy, may we not be so indifferent, we may not be so apathetic that we don't really care that the way we think and the way we process things all too often is a lie. Jesus says, do not lie. And we think that means, well, I'm not made up something that's a bold-faced lie. There are so many variations of lying that we justify. Help us, Lord, to be aware of it and to stop it. In Jesus' name, amen.